Welcome to a special Christmas edition of the Ian Edison Security Podcast. I'm your host, Pion.
And I'm a festive Dick Turnip.
That's a festive Dick Turnip. On tonight's episode, we'll be looking at cross-site scripting attacks. What are they? How do we implement them? And what's the best methods for defense? We'll also be discussing our first hacking conference here in the southeast of Ireland's CampusCon. But first, the news. Kepler finds Earth-sized planets. It's been a great year for the Kepler mission, which announced a number of discoveries this year. This week, NASA announced the discovery of Kepler-20f, the first Earth-sized planet found orbiting a star similar to our Sun. A second planet, Kepler-20e, was found in the same system and is only marginally smaller than the Earth. Neither planet appeared to be in the Goldilocks zone, but the find is still remarkable and provides evidence for the potential existence of life outside of Earth. The system is not exactly our close neighbour, being 945 light years away. The Kepler mission has confirmed 28 planets so far.
At least the SETI program will have something to point its satellites at.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting, this Kepler mission. Earlier in the year, they found a planet that was in the actual Goldilocks zone, but I think it was four times the size of Earth. It's what they call a super Earth. So they didn't think that it would be suitable for life in regards to the size and how much gravity it would have. But it was within the actual Goldilocks zone. So now what they've found is two Earth-sized planets, but they are too hot. They're too close to the star. But this is the first Earth-sized planet found outside of the solar system. So it's an important find. So the more of these planets they find, they're eventually going to find one that meets every piece of criteria to where it could support life. And then they can indeed point the SETI satellites at whichever planet.
It'd be really interesting to see how things progress. I can't imagine that the SETI satellite's going to pick anything up in our lifetime. But you never know. We might would it even be let known to the public if they did find something? There's a question.
Yeah, I think they would, to be honest. But the thing is, there was one called the WOW signal a few years back. I'm not sure the exact date. It could have been in the 80s or 90s, but they found the WOW signal, which they thought was extraterrestrial. It's kind of one of those hot topics. I didn't read too much into it lately, but it's worth Googling. Check out the wiki page for WOW signal. Well, the thing with the SETI program is that they're kind of looking for a needle in a haystack. They're just listening to select parts of the sky with no real purpose behind it. They're just hoping that it's gonna hit pop black. What they're doing with the Kepler program now is they're actually going to be able to find planets that are capable of sustaining life, and then they could start pointing the satellites specifically to these planets. So they're not going to be looking for a needle in a haystack exactly. They'll have a better chance of finding life, but they've also got to find life that exists within a certain window. There's Drake formula is worth looking at for seeing what sort of percentage of planets have life, and then what sort of percentage of that life becomes intelligent, and then what's the window that is open for when that life exists, because most life goes extinct anyway. So look, it's interesting. The next 50 years are going to be very, very interesting times for space travel. We've got the Dawn probe, which recently visited the Vesta asteroid in between Mars and Jupiter, and it's going to Ceres next, which is it's a dwarf planet in between Jupiter and Mars. Not many people actually know about it, but there is a planet in between Jupiter and Mars called Ceres, and it's a dwarf planet. It's very small, but it is round, and they're going to be hitting that in 2015. So the pictures, it'd be interesting to see what the pictures look like, whether it has a noticeable atmosphere, of it's just rocky, barren nonsense, you know?
Or as the doomsday says, reckon it's going to hit us in 2012.
I think they're on too much wacky tobacco, to be honest. So, moving on, backdoor in Android, no permissions, reverse shell. A security expert, Thomas Cannon, working at Voya Forensics as a director of research and development, has demonstrated a custom development app which installs a backdoor into Android smartphones without requiring any permissions or exploiting any security holes. Thomas built the app, which requires no permissions and yet is able to give an attacker a remote shell and allow them to execute arbitrary commands on the device remotely from anywhere in the world. The functionality they are exploiting, however, is not new, and it was quietly pointed out for a number of years, was explained in depth at DEF CON 18. In depth, it states that the application operates by instructing the browser to access a specific web page with particular parameters. This web page with a server behind it will in turn control the app by forwarding the browser to a URL that starts with a protocol prefix that is registered as being handled by the app, for example, app :// This process can then be repeated, and in doing so enables two-way communication. So it's not something new, but the app itself is new. It would be interesting. It would be interesting to test it out. I'll have a Google of it later myself, and I'll test it out on my own phone. Also, simple HTML tag will crash Windows 7. When using Safari browser, an iframe with an overly large height attribute can cause a blue screen of death error on 64-bit systems. It could allow for malicious code injection at the kernel level, but it doesn't affect the 32-bit versions of Windows 7. Also, the ongoing saga between Bradley Manning and Adrian Lamo and the United States government. Lamo has taken... Is it Lamo or Lamo? I can't remember.
Lamo. Call him Lamo because he's lame.
Yeah. Well, Lamo has taken the stand on the fifth day of the Manning trial. Special Agent Antonio Patrick Edwards confirms that Lamo was not an official informant at the time of the chat logs, but became one in July 2010 and remained one until around 3 months ago. Lamo was not a paid informant, but was paid travel and expenses in relation to his research. Lamo contacted a Manning acquaintance named Danny Clark via online chat and subsequently handed the logs to law enforcement, even though he had agreed not to. And this is really pissed off at the... suppose the hacking community. We saw at the last Hope conference, Lamo took a grilling from not only the audience but from the panel members, including Fiber Optic. What's your take on this, Dick?
Well, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of Mr. Lamo. He's pretty duplicitous. It's the whole way that he promised someone that it was like a minister. You can treat it as a confessional, or you can treat it as like I'm a journalist, but this isn't for print. So he's luring people into giving him information under false pretext, and I just think that it just stinks. I mean, there's enough mistrust in the hacking community anywhere without having people like Liam Moore entrapping people so he can progress his own career and further his own cause for fame, I would say. I think he's the whole reason that he dobbed Manning in the first place. Well, if it was Bradley Manning, it's not been decided in trial yet, but the whole reason that he dobbed him in for the files was to self-publicise.
Yeah, that appears to be the case. Also, I've noticed a transformation of Lamo from his earlier appearances on the likes of Tech TV's screensavers and more recent appearances by Lamo. I'm not exactly sure if it's medication that he's taken, but there's definitely a sort of absence of I can only describe of a soul. You know, he comes across very robotic and very monotone. And there's definitely something that's happened. There's definitely a change in the way he speaks, the way he acts, his mannerisms, everything have changed. So I'm not sure whether it's a medical condition or not, but that was very evident from just listening to his latest interviews. But he certainly doesn't have many friends left in the hacking community, that's for sure.
Nope, and he doesn't deserve any either.
Yeah, I agree.
I think what it is being on the Kim Jong-un diet.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, actually, yeah, recently Kim Jong-il passed away, didn't he? Leader of the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea. That's quite a mouthful, isn't it?
I'm not going to say it. I had enough trouble before.
Yeah, Democratic People's Republic of North Korea. I don't know. It's kind of a redundant name, isn't it? Because there's no democracy in North Korea. There's 2 million people starving. And Didn't he? I was reading an article a few days ago. I think it was yesterday, actually, about Kim Jong Il. It was just like the weird things he's done as a leader. Apparently, he kidnapped a director and his assistant from South Korea to make movies for him. They had him kidnapped for a few years, and they eventually won his trust and said they wanted to go to some sort of film conference or whatever in Europe. And as soon as they went to Europe, they defected, went back to South Korea. So, but he was a bit peculiar, all right.
He was a good actor, though. He was brilliant in Team America.
Oh, yeah, he was great in Team America. So Team America do exist. Also, Christopher Hitchens passed away a few days ago. Great hero of mine. Great public speaker. Great critical thinker. Atheist, author. There's so many titles you could have for Christopher Hitchens. But I do admire him. He was always pushing the envelope. He never fitted one side of the political spectrum. He was, on the right and on some issues, and on the left on other issues. But he always, any stance he ever took, he could always back it up, and that's what I respected about him. I suppose people who are involved in the creationist movement wouldn't have too many kind words for Christopher Hitchens. But I admire him. I think he's it's a great loss to the world, the world indeed.
Yeah, he's not a guy that I'm familiar with, to be honest. I'd heard his name, but I hadn't really took anything that he'd done. And, I like the title of the book that you were telling me about earlier.
Yeah, he's wrote a number of books over the years. Most of them attacking religion. One was on Mother Teresa called The Missionary Position, and the other one is God Is Not Great, Where Religion or How Religion Poisons Everything. So. He's an interesting guy. He was a unique mind, for sure.
Yeah, that's the Westboro Baptist Church going to be picketing the iNetism podcast now.
Yeah, sure, we can deal with the traffic. That's it. So moving along, we've a conference upcoming here in Waterford called CampusCon. It's been hosted by the WIT Hacking Society, and it's the first hacking conference here hosted ever in the southeast of Ireland. It's going to be interesting. And my good friend Dick Turnip is coming over for the trip.
Yep, everything goes to plan. I'll be there.
Yeah, it's the first conference that we're hosting here in Waterford. It's going to be a number of speakers. I'm going to be giving a talk on an introduction to SQL injection. There's going to be also talks on writing mobile applications with the clouds, and then two interesting topics. When I grow up, I want to be a cyber terrorist, and that's Kemp, and then also the politics of security, what's being done about computer crime, and why does it matter? I think that's by Matthew Hughes. Maybe I've mixed them up, I'm not sure. But the website is campuscon.hackingwit.com. For anyone who wants to come along, it's on the 21st of January in Waterford City. And if you're living anywhere in Ireland, make the drive down. If you're living anywhere over in the UK, just get a flight over, Ryanair, €20, €30 max, and you're good to go. We're also going to have a team hacking challenge. I'm currently designing it at the moment. So it's going to be a three-layer challenge that incorporates both system level attacks and web application level attacks. So you'll have to complete one layer to get onto the next layer, and then whoever gets to the final layer first wins, and each layer hacked will give your team 5 points, a maximum of 5 people per team. So are you going to get a Team England over?
Well, I'm coming over with a few guys. Matthew Hughes was living in my city a while ago. I've met Matthew, and he's a nice guy, and I've talked to Mike more than a couple of times on Twitter, and I know a couple of guys that's met Mike, so it'll be interesting to meet Mike. He's apparently he's a really funny guy, so I'm looking forward to it. She'll be really good, and of course the listeners of the podcast might not know this, but me and you have never actually met in person, have we?
Yeah, we've known each other online for about 10-11 years, and we've not met as of yet. So this is going to be the first eyeball, I suppose, which is I'm looking forward to, because we have good banter, and it'll be interesting to finally catch up. And we may, it's not set in stone yet, but we may be recording the Ian Edison Security Podcast from the event, if all goes according to plan.
Yeah, I think that would be a really, really interesting thing to do, because the sort of idea is that we could maybe set up a table and a microphone and a laptop and have people come and sit down and talk to us and talk about the conference, and I think we'll get some interesting feedback, and I think we'll probably make a good show.
Yeah, I think so. There's going to be more than enough people anyways to get it. We'll just have to work on managing sounds and noise and all that good stuff. So yeah, it's going to be interesting. I'm looking forward to it, and especially looking forward to the challenge. Well, I'm not going to be entering the challenge because it's my challenge, but I'm looking to see how people get on. It's going to be, I'd say this about the challenge is that it's going to be challenging enough for people who are new to security, but not so challenging that they won't be able to complete it. And for people who are seasoned penetration testers, they should be able to complete the challenge, but it will be fun, and it'll be still a slight challenge for them to complete it. So it's going to be good. We've got a dedicated server set up for it, or we will. I've got the first part of it coded, and good to go. That's the web application part of it. So that's all coded. It's ready to go. I've just got to set up the server itself now and code that part of the challenge. And yeah, it'll be interesting. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it'll be really good. Be really good. And it's a shame that you're not going to be taking part, because I was going to ask to be on your team.
Yeah, I've designed a number of challenges online for boards.ie as well, a number of web application security challenges. Also, Damo, who usually frequents the Irish 2600 channel on irc.2600.net, he also designs a number of challenges. So I do like the challenges, because they provide, especially mine and Damo's, they provide kind of a real-world scenario where you've got an attack a robust web application, and you know, either gain admin or get details, information details, stuff like that. So it's going to be interesting. If I didn't design a challenge, then someone else would have to design it. That's the only way that I would have been able to be on a team. But no, I'm happy enough to design it. I've halfway done now anyway. I think at the WIT Hacking Society will be a little bit sad that I'm not on their team to give them a hand. But I'm sure they'll be good to go by the time it comes around. But I'm not going to give them any hints. I'm not giving anyone hints. So don't hit me up on Twitter for hints. It's going to be an equal playing field for everyone.
Well, I think with the Hacking Challenge coming up with the website of things, you've got a little XSS tutorial for us, haven't you?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to cover that now in a second. Cross-site scripting. There probably won't be any cross-site scripting involved, but that's not to say that you shouldn't keep your mind open, because I may add a cross-site scripting onto it. So I'm not saying anymore, but you'll see on the 21st of January. So yeah, moving along, cross-site scripting, what is it? How do we implement it, and how do we defend against it? Well, essentially what cross-site scripting is, it's a user-injected script into a web page, and what that does is allows an attacker to execute client-side code on a victim's browser. So that's the important parts to note, that it's a client-side attack. What happens is that you inject the code into a web page, and that code is executed on a victim's browser. So there's two basic forms of cross-site scripting. Now you can go beyond this, but at a basic level, there's reflected cross-site scripting, which is non-persistent, i.e. it's not saved in a database, and then there's stored, which is persistent cross-site scripting, and that's saved in a database. So stored is obviously the most dangerous. Reflected, I suppose, is more common to find, but it's less dangerous. But that's not to say that you can't implement any attacks on them. How you might see a reflected cross-site scripting attack would be perhaps on a search engine, and you inject your code into the search engine, which executes that code on its results when it returns the results. And what you could do is you could copy and paste that to a victim. And when they load that URL, it actually executes JavaScript from the browser. It's actually in the URL. It's embedded into the URL. A few things I suppose you could do with the reflected cross-site scripting would be a fake login. So if you had a website that you wanted to get the credentials of someone, you could social engineer them by providing them with a link. Mm-hmm. So setting the href of your link to be the actual injection, like the code, but having the text part of the link just to look like a normal link, so they just click on it and they execute the code. So you could have an overlay, just do a JavaScript or CSS overlay, and overlay the actual legitimate login screen with an exact replica of that login screen. So once they execute the code, once they enter the login details, it submits it to your. You might have a script to save it, or you might have a database to log it, and then whatever. So that's reflected cross-site scripting. But the most important one, I suppose, is stored. Mm-hmm. And what stored works, how stored works, is that suppose you have a blog website. Let's say you've got a normal user and an admin user. Let's say there's no filtering going on a blog post. What you could do is you could enter a post with JavaScript. You submit that post to the server. The server stores it in the database, and then anyone who loads the web page makes a request to the database server to pull certain information back so it can display it on the web page. Mm-hmm. And amongst that information will be your JavaScript code. So anyone who loads the web page will actually execute that code. So that's why it's multifaceted, and you can attack more than one user at any one time. So it's very highly dangerous, and it's a lot easier to work with as well, rather than trying to con someone in through social engineering with a URL or whatsoever. So stored is interesting. So generally how you would test for cross-site scripting is that the hello world of cross-site scripting would be just to get an alert message open. So for example, if it was a search engine, you might just put in script and then just use an alert function to just alerts, just a test message like hello world test XSS, whatever, it doesn't matter what you test it. And if that executes that code, you know it's vulnerable to cross-site scripting. Now in the search engine, it would be vulnerable to reflected cross-site scripting, but in the blog post, if you could perform a test message to execute, then you know that it's vulnerable to stored cross-site scripting. So just from chatting to a lot of people kind of, they get to this point in cross-site scripting and they say, okay, I've got the alert message, I know it's vulnerable to cross-site scripting, but what exactly can I do from here? So there is a number of attacks. One I highlighted already was with the reflected attack, which is where you would overlay the login screen or the login table or whatever it may be with a replica, and that would submit their details to your server rather than the legitimate server. Another one, a more interesting one, is session hijacking.
Cookie monster.
yeah, cookie monster. So the idea is, when you're authenticated with a system, what it does is to ensure that you stay authenticated for every web page that you view. You will be authenticated via a session. And the session allows the server to recognize and identify who you are and that you are a legitimate user. But what you can do is that, and you can do this yourself, if you just go to any website that has any website at all, but any website in particular that has a login, that you've got a login, if you just in your address bar, just type in JavaScript and then a colon and then alert, and then in the brackets, just type in document.cookie and just hit return. It'll actually load up your current cookie for that page. And the idea is that what you want to do is that you want to change your session cookie to replicate what the current either admin or a super super user with higher privileges. So the idea how an attack like this would work is that, let's say my previous example, you have a blog. The blog has got two different levels of users. One is that it's the normal standard user, and all he can do is post blog entries to the page. And then there's the admin user, which can delete entries, update entries, add users, delete users, make users admins, send out mail to a mailing list, all these features that only an admin can do. So the idea would be is that in this example, you've got a blog post, you've tested out the alert message, you see that the alert message pop up, you know that it's not filtering for cross-site scripting attacks. So instead of using an alert message, what you could do is use the following, and I'll post the code on the website, because like I said, when I was doing the SQL injection examples, it's very hard to follow code just listening. But if I post code examples on the actual entry for this podcast, it'll make it a lot easier. So just follow the code, and this will make a lot more sense for you. So in the script, in between the script tags, what you do is you're going to create a new image object. So just do new image, and then brackets dot source. And the source, what you're going to do is you're going to point to a script on your server, and I'll provide a PHP code for a sample script for this also. So what the script is going to do is it's going to take a value. It's going to take a value to the script, and it's going to store it. But that value is going to actually be the cookie value of whoever's executing that code at that time. So, for example, if it's the admin that's executing it, what it's going to do is going to submit the admin's session cookie to your server. And to complete the attack, what you would do is you would just use any cookie editor, check your session cookie, and just change it to the admin session cookie. Now, it's got to be valid. You've got to get the timing down right on this. But once you do it, you will have admin privileges. You'll be logged in as the admin. Now, there's ways to protect against this, like with secure cookies and that, but there's still a lot of web applications, especially not commercial packages, but a lot of kind of, you know, part-time web designers. Their scripts will be vulnerable to this. So the idea, like I said, is that you're creating a new image object, and you're pointing the source to a script, and you're passing an encoded URI value of document.cookie. And that will, your script obviously will store it, and then you're editing your cookie. So it's a really interesting way to hijack someone's cookie. And like I said, I'll explain this on the website in a lot more detail. So you following so far, Dick?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, you're good.
So I'm just looking a bit of code, because I was browsing in the background while you're talking there. You know how you can point the script to a web server of your own, so you can get the cookie. What's the chances of getting caught? I mean,
The thing is that the chances of getting caught doing this are very, very low, because it's done in the background. The JavaScript code is executed in the background, and it's executed as silent code. So unless they actually examine the source code of the web page, they won't know that this attack has happened. So you could write a perfectly legitimate blog post, but at the very end of the blog post, enter in your cross-site scripting attack, your JavaScript, and it executes. But this example, like the alert message, obviously they'll know that you've executed a cross-site scripting attack because it's visible. What you're doing is you're creating a new image object in JavaScript, and you're pointing the source. So what it's doing, essentially what's happening, is that it's trying to create a new image object, and it's checking out the source. But what it's doing is it's executing that URL. They're executing that URL in their browser, and what that is doing is, on your remote system, all it does is it runs a script. Let's say you call it log.php, and it's passing a cookie parameter with the viewer's cookie. So the chances of getting caught are very, very low, because it's not visible. It's silent. It's silent code.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's all I was wondering.
Yeah, it's an interesting attack. It's a really interesting attack. It's one of the more common ones. But like I said, a lot of people, they understand kind of the concept of cross-site scripting, but they're afraid to venture beyond the alert message because it just comes across as too complex to them. So don't be afraid to venture. And this is only one attack. There's a lot more attacks out there. If you know JavaScript, use your head. Think of what other attacks you could do. There's people write keyloggers in JavaScript. There's lots of stuff you can do in it. Actually, I recommend people to check out the browser exploitation framework, Beef, which is it's a framework which has modules already pre-built to perform these attacks. So what you would do, instead of embedding your own custom JavaScript, you just embed the hook file for the Beef framework. And what that will actually do is when someone executes that hook JavaScript file, it will actually hook their browser into your Beef, your Beef control panel, and then you've got a list of different attacks that you can perform on them. There's lots of stuff, like from checking out their browser version, you can tie it into Metasploit. There's even silly stuff like you can Rickroll them. You can deface the web page that they're currently on live. There's lots of stuff you can do. So I was going to give a talk. I'll probably go in depth a bit more about Beef on another show, because it deserves its a full show to discuss it in depth. But it's a great program, and I recommend anyone who's toying around with cross-site scripting to definitely download the Beef framework and just give it a look and practice some examples with it. So I think one of the things with cross-site scripting is that people are kind of unsure how to defend against cross-site scripting. And a lot of people, they either won't filter at all, or they use very poor blacklists. And what I mean by a blacklist is that they're stating, this is what you cannot enter, this is what you cannot enter. But unless you write a really, really refined blacklist, which is possible, it's just very difficult, what's going to happen is that if you say you're not allowed to do this, you're not allowed to do this, you're not allowed to do this, you could be writing, literally pages of code just to state what you can't write. So what you should be doing is writing whitelists saying, this is what you can do. This is the expected parameters that you can enter. Anything that deviates outside of that will not be executed. Also, regards to session hijacking, you should use these secure cookies. And it's also important to point out the difference between client-side filtering and checks, and server-side filtering and checks. So an example of client-side filtering and checks is that if you've ever registered for a website and they ask you to put in your email address and you made a mistake, you forget the @ sign or anything, they tell you to please enter a valid email address. That's a client-side check. And what's happening is that there's JavaScript in the background, which has been executed by your browser. And if you don't enter in the appropriate values, it'll inform you. But you can get around that by using the likes of Firebug or just editing the web page directly yourself, editing the HTML, and you can remove that JavaScript. So that's not really, from a security standpoint, that wouldn't be used. It wouldn't be beneficial. It's more to just kind of catch out honest mistakes that people might make. If you want to filter people, you're going to have to do it server side. So client side is kind of just to stop people making mistakes. Server side filtering in the actual script, so let's say it's PHP, that's where you do your filtering, your bounds checking, your validation of input from the users.
Yes, you should always put your server side scripting code in to keep it secure. And with PHP, it's fairly simple. You can check that the request being made from the web page is actually being sent from the server that it should be, because like you say, you can save a copy of the website, can't you, and you can upload it to your own web server and strip out the JavaScript and then send requests from your web server.
Yeah, or well, alternatively, it's like I said, you can use Firebug, which allows you to actually edit the HTML code on the fly. So with Firebug, if you have a web page, let's say you've got a web page and there's JavaScript on it, you can actually just open Firebug, and what Firebug does is it shows you that web page, it's HTML, it's code, and you can actually delete parts of the code from the page, and it's still live in the page. So you're not actually downloading the page. The page is already live in your browser. You're editing the actual web page live. So if anyone is not familiar with Firebug, check that out as well. That's a must-have for anyone who's interested in security. It's a must have. It's a great addition to Firefox. I'm not sure if it's available for Chrome yet. I quite like Chrome because it's very lightweight, but in terms of web hacking, it's all about Firefox.
Yeah, I've never used Firebug before, so that's something that I will be looking at and having to play with, and I'll let you know how how I get on.
Excellent. Also, check out, there's a lot of those, there's a lot of kind of web hacking websites online. Security Override, I think, is one of them, and there's a few of them. Check them out, because they give you these kind of web hacking challenges where you'll have to use the likes of Firebug and cookie editors and all these common things that you'll use in real-world environments when doing pen testing for web applications. So check out all those websites. Just have a Google of online hacking websites, stuff like that, and you'll find them. You get to practice makes perfect, as they say.
That's the main thing with hacking. You've just got to keep going, keep plodding away. You learn something new. It's a constant process. You're always learning new things. And anyone who tells you that they're an uber hacker is lying, really, because there's always new things being released and people keep learning. So if you're a beginner, then you've just got to, don't get disheartened by the things that might sound complicated. You just got to keep practicing, keep doing it, and try and find situations, like real world situations, that you can don't go breaking into websites, obviously, because you'll just get yourself arrested.
Exactly.
But find the software that'll allow you to carry out the attacks and try things out.
Yeah, and there's a lot of you know, software out there now that you can practice on, like the likes of WebGoat, Damn Vulnerable Web App, stuff like these. You can practice all common attacks: cross-site scripting, cross-site request forgery, SQL injection, all this. You can practice all these from a legal standpoint, or just do what I do and just code your own web applications, because what you're doing is you're learning how the code works at a back end level, and then you're learning how to attack it at a front end level. So it's if you want to learn how to code web applications, I suppose what better thing to code than a vulnerable web application, which are quite easy to code, by the way, because all you're doing is just, you're just being lazy. Just develop any web application and be lazy about it. Don't worry about input validation and that. And there you go. There's your web application. It's cross-site scripting is very interesting. But like you said, anyone who's new to security, don't be afraid to learn a new area, new fields. If something seems complex at first, just keep at it, practice at it, and after, you know, a few weeks, it won't seem complex anymore, and it'll come a lot more natural to you. So don't let stuff throw you off, like buffer overflow, SQL injection, all these terms you'll hear and you'll feel like it's a little bit over my head, but it never is over your head. All you've got to do is just give it a few weeks, and it'll become first nature to you. So practice makes perfect, as Dick said.
Yeah, the hardest thing about hacking is learning all the jargon.
Yeah, that's it, all the jargon. Once you get past the jargon, that's half the work done.
I would also suggest that if you are going to build insecure web applications to test in your own sandbox environment, to start off with PHP, because PHP makes it really easy to code insecure applications.
That's it. And PHP is an easy language to pick up. You can create a very, very decently sized web application, which has, you know, a lot of complex user input in relatively short amount of code. So PHP is very easy to pick up and learn. Anyone who just wants a quick introduction into it, check out the TizAG, that's TIZAG, TizAG PHP and MySQL tutorial. It's just very short, brief introduction to creating a page that selects certain fields from a database or inserts in the database, stuff like that. So it's very, very useful tutorial. And once you've got the basics down, then it's just a matter of just using your imagination. So that's it for now. That's the end of our Christmas special. We've missed a few weeks, but we will be back full time in the new year again. And if you've missed any of the episodes, be sure to listen to them all. And in particular, check out the interview with Beav, I think was in our previous episode. It's a great show where he discusses the OpenVMS operating system, the Telefreak project, and war dialing. Weird and peculiar foreign networks. It's a really great show. So for now, I'm Pion.
I'm Dick Turnip.
And that's Dick Turnip. We'll see you in the new year. Bye for now.